Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your live Friday morning roundup of Utah news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we'll be talking about the special session of the Utah legislature. Lawmakers met this week to allocate federal coronavirus relief funds, but somehow guns, masks, and critical race theory ended up on the agenda as well. Plus, with the best record in basketball, the Utah Jazz are headed to the NBA playoffs. So how far can the team go? And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. Good morning, Bethany. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We've also got Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome, Robert. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Roger.
And a little bit later on the show, we are going to hear from Utah Jazz beat writer Eric Walden for that playoff preview. As always, we invite our listeners to join this discussion with your questions and comments. You can tweet to at KCPW, or you can call 801-355-8255. That is 801-355-TALK. All right, well, the legislature held a special session. Governor Spencer Cox called the session to tackle budgetary issues related to those federal funds for coronavirus relief, to make some technical changes to bills that passed at the last session, and to consider a couple of bills that lawmakers were introducing. He explicitly told lawmakers not to tackle a couple of items that were being floated, making Utah a so-called Second Amendment sanctuary state and considering legislation to ban critical race theory in Utah K-12 schools. We're actually going to start today with something else that lawmakers want to see banned in Utah schools, and that is masks. Bethany Rogers, you covered this for the Salt Lake Tribune. This wasn't among the items that the governor had told lawmakers not to consider. In fact, it's a measure that he is in favor of. But what are the specifics here? Just schools are not allowed to require masks? It's that simple?
Yeah, basically, public schools, public K-12 schools and universities are not allowed to be the ones that it would impose a mask mandate on students or teachers or within, you know, a school building or on a campus. I guess a couple clarifications. This relates specifically to the coronavirus, so it doesn't relate to, other diseases. And it's also important to note, according to the sponsor, that mask mandates would still be possible in schools. It's just that the local school districts and schools themselves and, you know, university leaders wouldn't be able to be the ones imposing them. And instead, that decision would fall to the, you know, local legislative body. It could, you know, what lawmakers said is that if there's an outbreak in a school, for instance, the school leaders or the local school district could go to the county and the county health department and kind of consult with them, and they could issue a mandate for masks in schools. And, you know, a statewide mandate would be possible sort of in the same vein, but they say they just wanted to clarify who's really in charge of the decision to impose mask mandates in schools. Now, critics of this would say, and did say, that this is really taking the power and the control and the decision-making authority away from the people who are most directly involved with the schools, which are, you know, the educators and the school districts themselves, and that it would create slowdowns, delays, you know, that could possibly even be dangerous if you wait until an outbreak and then kind of get the ball rolling then.
There's that's one aspect of it. The other aspect was the kind of conservative argument that was being made against this bill, and that was made, or well, at least one person making that was Representative Melissa Ballard from North Salt Lake, Republican representative. Can you explain what she said?
Yeah, well, you often hear Republican lawmakers in the legislature talk about the importance of local control. It's kind of like a guiding principle for them that government is done best closest to the people, and that, you know, the state legislature gets mad when, for instance, the federal government sort of takes away some of their power, tells them what to do. And in the same way, they've, you know, argued that the state legislature should basically leave decisions as much as possible up to local governing bodies that are, you know, closer to the communities that they serve. And so her argument was that this This bill completely kind of goes against that principle. And she also raised the point that, last year when the governor was imposing mask mandates, the state legislature got very angry about that as sort of taking away local control. And she said, well, you know, how can the state legislature, also a state governing body, then step in and tell locals what to do? Isn't that sort of hypocritical? That's the word that she used, hypocritical, of them to, on the one hand, say the state government shouldn't be imposing masks,
right?
But then also come back and say the state should, you know, take away the ability to impose masks.
It's interesting. What about just, you know, the fact that many kids still don't have access to coronavirus vaccines? Was that something that lawmakers debated at all, Bethany, the fact that wasn't there? And then I guess another question that I have that is sort of rolled into that is, if I'm a student who wants to wear a mask, or the parent of a student who wants their kid to wear a mask, that can still happen, right?
Yeah, nothing in the bill precludes someone from wearing a mask if they want to in a school setting. And then on the question of vaccines, that did come up in the legislature. Representative Jennifer Daley Provo, you know, called attention to the fact that younger kids, younger than 12, still don't have access. When she asked about that, the sponsor of the bill basically said, well, yeah, but these are relatively low-risk populations. When, you know, you look at the people who fall seriously ill from the coronavirus, you know, younger children are the ones, you know, that often don't fall seriously ill. But she said, you know, that despite that, there are very, you know, immunocompromised kids or kids with underlying conditions, and that the coronavirus has made some children extremely sick, and that even though it's, you know, a lower risk, that it still is a risk. So she said, you know, even one kid dying or falling seriously ill would be too many.
Mm-hmm. And that was Representative Jen Daley Provo. We were talking earlier about Representative Melissa Garf Ballard, who was, if I'm not mistaken from the reporting, she was on oxygen because she is still facing lingering effects from her case of COVID-19, right?
Yeah, she did. She had a bout with COVID-19 that she, you know, was hospitalized for and is still on oxygen. And also her father died from COVID-19. So she's had a couple of, you know, very personal experiences with the disease, and it's taken a great personal toll on her. But she said that really didn't have anything to do with her opposition to the bill, that her opposition to the bill was on principle, that, you know, state lawmakers shouldn't interfere with local decision making.
Hmm. We talked about the end of mask mandates in schools. I thought that the governor made that adjustment, and Bethany, maybe just before I bring in Robert Gehrke, the governor made that adjustment earlier, but is there a difference between the governor and his authority over schools and what this bill does? Meaning, did the governor say at one point, we're going to stop masks from being required in schools, and kind of did that by his own hand, I guess, his own power? This bill is a step beyond that?
I think the argument is that this bill provides some assurance and clarity that that there won't be masks in the fall when kids return to school. That's kind of what the proponents of this bill had said. And there were some parents who, you know, are ardently opposed to masks in schools, who have really been pressuring lawmakers to do something on this. You know, as you noted, you know, Governor Spencer Cox has already said schools don't have to wear masks in the last week of classes. And he's also said there won't be any masks in the fall. You know, however, this bill really kind of guarantees it at a local level. You know, your local school leaders can't impose a mask mandate. And I guess the point is that it kind of provides some assurance that they won't be the ones kind of calling the shots, and some clarity about who would be in charge of that decision if it were made.
Right. Let's do bring in Robert Gehrke, a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Robert, I'm sick of wearing masks, sick of talking about them too. And, you know, sick of them though, sick of them or not, I guess, is it doesn't really matter. What really does matter here is, well, some sort of metric that, that guides decision making. I guess what's your two cents on this, Robert?
Well, I mean, we kind of talked about this a couple of weeks ago when the governor first lifted it. The practical effect of this legislation is pretty minimal in the sense that, you know, as we noted, the governor's lifted it already. He said we're not going to have masks in the fall, and you know, it seems likely that that's, you know, would hold barring some sort of big reversal in the trends we're seeing. So really what it comes down to is this is the legislature flexing its muscle, you know, in a fairly meaningless way. And so you got, you know, and I think Representative Ballard made a good point about the local control issue. And you know, the this should be something that's, that parents and principals and teachers and administrators and local school boards and local county health officials get to decide. But, you know, here we are. It's a politicized issue. It's not being driven by the science. Again, hopefully it shouldn't matter. I think our trends are looking good. You know, they were already going to, masks were already going to be gone within, you know, the next week or two. And so it's a little bit of a flex by the legislature. I thought it was interesting that you know, as Bethany noted, Representative Ballard voted against this. The another Republican who voted against it was Representative John Hawkins, who was hospitalized, you know, nearly died from the COVID-19 scare that he had. And so there seems to be a little bit of a different perspective, it seems, among those who've had it versus those who have not.
Right, depending upon, though, as Bethany pointed out, Representative Ballard said that wasn't the reason she was making her vote. Just to wrap this up and move on, Bethany, the governor, Governor Spencer Cox, says that he will sign this. As he pointed out in his press conference yesterday, he's in favor of this.
Yeah, he said he was supportive of it. I mean, like Robert said, it doesn't really seem that likely that it would do very much, but he said that, you know, he doesn't have a problem signing it into law.
Okay. I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK or by tweeting to us at, our handle is at KCPW, though I need to go and look at that. And Bethany, there are just, we're going to go into other things that happened at the special session. There are two resolutions that also passed at the legislature. You covered largely the, you know, the governor's response to these resolutions. One of them has to do with guns, making Utah a so-called Second Amendment sanctuary state. And there are actually separate resolutions in the House and Senate on this, both essentially saying the same thing. And just to start off with, I'm going to actually play a couple of clips from floor debate on the Senate side. And we will start with Senate Majority Leader Evan Vickers explaining the rationale behind this resolution here. Take a listen.
We live in a state that holds a lot of things dear. And one thing is the Second Amendment and right to bear arms. There is a concern right now amongst our citizens, a significant concern that maybe some of those rights could be taken away. And I will say maybe. This is what it is. It's a resolution that tees up for some further discussion at a later date, most likely in the general session. But we do have different administration in place right now in Washington, D.C. There has been some rumors and indications that there could be executive orders or other action taken that could possibly limit some of those Second Amendment rights. So this is, as you'll look at this resolution, it's about as short as you're ever going to see a resolution. It simply says that we are concerned about those rights. The legislature is a state. The legislature is concerned about it. And we support, you know, having further discussion about other legislative action that we could take place that would consider how we can protect those rights and even discussion about the establishment of Utah as a Second Amendment sanctuary state.
Okay, so some rumors and fears out there that things are looking bad for gun owners, and I'm just going to actually now play a response from a Democratic senator. This is Salt Lake Democratic Senator Gene Davis. Let's take a listen to him.
I'm just really perplexed that we're doing this. The Second Amendment, I believe, standing and doing a resolution in support of the rights of the Second Amendment and what it means is appropriate. We all believe in the Constitution. We all believe in that Second Amendment and the right. I have not heard any politicians say, we're coming to take your guns away. That is not going to happen. There's a right, and even the Supreme Court has said there's a defined right to own.
Again, Bethany Rogers, you covered some of the special session, and but I know that more specifically you wrote about the governor's response to this. First off, we should say that the resolutions on this Second Amendment sanctuary idea passed in both the House and Senate. And maybe you can sort of explain, Bethany, just sort of broadly what a resolution does, and then what did Governor Cox say about that after, he'd originally explicitly asked lawmakers not to tackle this issue and another, which we're going to get to in a little bit, but Cox was on board with this Second Amendment sanctuary resolution. Why was he on board when he had said, don't talk about this during the session?
Well, he didn't put on the special session agenda bills on these issues. And he basically made a case for, the legislature to wait and have a more deliberative process. He said, I can't remember, when we've considered a hot button issue or, two hot button issues like these in a special session. We need more time and space to think about it and talk about it. And it's more appropriate to handle in a general session. But the legislature decided to take on these issues by way of a resolution, which it's basically just a position statement or, a statement of opinion or a consensus among the legislature on a particular issue. It doesn't have the force of law. It doesn't, commit the state to any particular action. It's basically just, as I said, just words on paper. The governor kind of came back and basically just said, this resolution is in keeping with what I was asking for in the first place. The resolution on the Second Amendment sanctuary talks about, exploring the issue of turning the state into a sanctuary state. It doesn't say, that the legislature is going to do that. And it doesn't say that, it doesn't declare the state a sanctuary state. So it doesn't have any real world effect in that sense. So I think that his point was, this doesn't go against my call for more time in deliberation. It's actually kind of saying the same thing that I was saying.
Okay, to think about it more, to study it more, to consider the idea, but it's not actually doing anything. I want to play just one more clip before I bring in the opinion columnist, and it's sort of a bizarre one. This is Senator David Hinkins of Orangeville in Emory County. He made an analogy that was a bit interesting, and I'm going to play the clip, and then we'll come back to you, Robert Gerke. Hold on a second.
I'm very supportive of this, but I think it's hypocritical for people to support, one party to support sanctuary cities where they allow illegals to live in their city, but without being a U.S. citizens. But yet, when we want a sanctuary that's in our favor, it's just funny how opposite polarization we became as a nation and as a state. And it's very hypocritical to say that we should have sanctuary cities for one thing, but not for another. If it's going your direction, it's fine. If it's not, it's not okay. So anyway, I am supportive of this, and I vote aye.
So a sanctuary for, immigrants being equated to sanctuary for guns. Robert Gerke, news columnist, maybe, a comment on the bizarreness of politics before we head to a break in the show. What did you think of this debate if you followed it?
Well, I mean, I followed it sort of. I didn't pay too much attention to it, to be honest, because it, as Bethany noted, it's words on paper. It's kind of a meaningless gesture that doesn't have any legal weight. And if they did try to pass a bill that had some legal weight, these are likely unconstitutional because terms of interstate commerce, at least, and federal gun laws, there's a supremacy clause in the Constitution. So, you know, it's some chest pounding. I don't think it's surprising. The legislature really loves their guns, and so they're going to do some posturing on it and score some political points here. The question that arises for me out of this is, so which gun laws exactly are these, would we be ignoring or trying to disregard if this were to have some practical effect? Because I think there are gun laws, background checks, for example, bans on, machine guns, like fully automatic machine guns, that are pretty well established. And I don't know if we would be looking at trying to, reverse those in Utah or not. So, I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions if this were ever to actually have a practical impact. But as it right. stands, it's the legislature saying that they like guns, which we kind of all knew from, the get-go.
From square one. All right. Well, with that, we're going to head to a break, and we will leave it there, though we are, at the moment, we're not quite done with politics yet, or with messages, Robert Gerke. When we come back, we will turn to another resolution that was heard up on the Hill having to do with something called critical race theory. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW 88.3 FM, Salt Lake Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right. Well, lawmakers met on Wednesday in a special session for some tweaks to some legislation, but largely to allocate funds from the American Rescue Plan. And they did that, as the Tribune's Brian Schott reported, they spent roughly $100 million to backfill the unemployment fund. $50 million is earmarked for grants for businesses hit hard by the pandemic. $90 million to establish a mental health institute at the U of U. Another $100 million for water development and conservation. And we don't know the funding priorities there yet, but I imagine that a number of people will be curious about whether some of that goes to the Lake Powell pipeline, a contentious project. Some money for cybersecurity, broadband development, hunger, and housing, though on housing not as much as some folks had wanted, and some vaccine-related expenditures as well. Anyway, all of that is in Brian's article over at sltrib.com. I'm summarizing all of that because I want to turn to the other message bill that passed at the session having to do with critical race theory. And once again, Bethany Rogers, you covered the governor's response to this, not the bill itself as much up at the legislature, but I imagine that you've been following it to some extent. What's the rough idea behind this resolution, if you can address that, Bethany?
Well, this resolution came from a campaign. A group of parents have been very vocal in recent weeks, basically, demanding that the legislature do something to ban critical race theory in Utah schools. So, we talked earlier about Governor Cox's response to that. He said that he did not think it was appropriate to have, a controversial hot button issue like this kind of hastily dealt with in a special session. But instead of that, the legislature decided to move forward with a resolution kind of in the same way they did with the Second Amendment sanctuary resolution. So this, again, is just sort of a position statement, just words on paper, their opinion, basically saying, that they think that critical race theory is harmful, and says that, the legislature believes the theory degrades important societal values and would harm students if they learned it in classrooms. And then, basically strongly recommends that the State Board of Education look at the curriculum, public school curriculum, and make sure that it doesn't teach that, you know, any one race is superior or inferior, that it doesn't teach that anybody should be discriminated against. And it you know, there's nothing in curriculum that teaches that a person's character is racially determined. So those are kind of the three things that they're recommending. And I mean, the State Board of Education is already reviewing its curriculum, so they're already kind of doing this. So, you know, again, this statement won't really do much, but the legislature said they felt it was important to be responsive and kind of say something about this issue, since it's, you know, there's so much urgency and interest in it right now.
Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins had a good explainer on what is meant by critical race theory. Peyton's article says that fundamentally critical race theory is the idea that racism exists. She quotes a University of Utah professor who wrote that the theory asserted at its most basic premise that race and racism have been and still are a defining determining characteristic of American society, that racism is that. And then on the other side, she says that the criticism is that it's subjective and about storytelling. And just yesterday, Senator Mike Lee sent a letter to the Department of Education saying that this theory weaponizes diversity instead of celebrating diversity. Robert Gerke, news columnist, I'm going to bring you in a little bit earlier than normal because you wrote a column about this. And I'm wondering, you know, you wrote about the sort of hysteria that is taking hold over the concept of critical race theory, but I'm not certain I even understand what it is from the conversation that is happening. There's a sort of vagueness to what's being discussed, and I'm wondering if you can maybe elucidate for us what's happening.
I mean, you're right. There is a vagueness about it, and that's kind of one of the most frustrating things about it. The Senate sponsor of the resolution opposing critical race theory said at the outset of his presentation that he can't define what it is, and he was asked several times to define what it is and if it's being taught in Utah schools, and he couldn't point to an example of where it was being taught. So if we don't know what it is, and we don't know what it's, you know, if it's being taught in Utah schools, but we're against it being taught in Utah schools, I'm not exactly sure what they've accomplished here. You know, I mean, I think it is largely at this point in the eye of the beholder, because, you know, I mean, it wasn't originally in the eye of the beholder. There's an academic, you know, structure to it that's been existed for almost five decades. But in this instance, you know, this group of parents that are led by, you know, Natalie Klein, a state school board member, who they're you know, really upset about something that they think is being taught to their kids, and were able to organize effectively enough to, you know, push the legislature into adopting this without actually having any kind of, there's no definition of what critical race theory is anywhere in the resolution. And again, because they don't know what it is and they can't define it.
Robert, I don't mean to cut you off, but you in your column write about this, and you say that the legislature is taking marching orders from a cable news TV personality. Can you talk about that part of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has become a cause celeb for the conservative right wing, you know, blogosphere and Fox News. You know, it's something that has been drummed up into, you know, this boogeyman. And you know, rather than actually and this is what Governor Cox said he wanted to see, is take a rational approach, study what this is, define the problem, work through the issues, you know. That's what interim legislative sessions are for, is when you need to take time to study an issue and understand it before you act on it. They didn't bother to do any of that. They just went, you know, storming ahead, Pass this thing that said it degrades, you know, our values and it harms education, without saying how it does that or why it was necessarily does that or if it does that. And so it was kind of frustrating to me that this is, it just seems like a poor process to follow. And, you know, we'll see what the state school board comes up with. I'm hopeful that they can come up with something useful that sets some parameters on the way children are taught about the racial history of the United States, because it's an important issue that kids need to learn about, and they need to learn about it in that it's complex and not always a rosy, happy picture, and that we aren't past racism in this country. We're not. And it's something that, you know, we can't whitewash our history. We can't whitewash our current, you know, structures that are in place. And so, you know, there needs to be some awareness of that, I think, even at a fairly young age. But again, hopefully what they do is they get past these labels, because critical race theory, if we don't know what it is, beating each other over the head with that term isn't going to do us any good. We need to talk more specifically and more granularly about what kids should and should be learning in schools.
I'm going to turn back to Bethany Rogers on this, because Bethany, you covered the governor's response to the passage of this resolution, and he said something that was kind of interesting. He said that lawmakers, you know, felt that they need to get to the bottom of this, and he was okay with that because basically people had concerns, and since people had concerns, they had to be addressed. Is that sort of summarizing what he said in a nutshell?
Yeah, basically. I mean, he basically conceded that, or he said there is no evidence that critical race theory is being taught in our schools. The State Board of Education is already, you know, examining this, looking to create better definitions for some of these things that are poorly, you know, that can be vague and different people have different ideas of what they are. So, you know, he said that. He alluded to the fact that cable news is, you know, potentially fueling this current situation, then all of the outrage about this in Utah and among these Utah parents, but then also kind of said, well, misguided or not, misplaced or not, as this anger is, it's elected officials' job to respond to it in some way and to figure out, you know, what the true information is, and to, you know, kind of deal with the situation as it is, even if, you know, it's sort of manufactured by the, you know, cable news
talking heads, media
echo chambers and stuff like that. So that was kind of where he was coming from. You should be responsive, even if you don't necessarily agree with what your constituents are afraid of.
I mean, yeah, and he said that he hadn't watched cable news in some amount of time, said he was 7 years sober from cable news or whatever. But I'm wondering, you know, if he's talking about the idea of getting to the bottom of that and you know, sort of dispassionately looking at it. But this resolution is critical of this theory that, I mean, to me, it sounds like the fundamental difference here, you know, is whether racism is playing a central role today in America, and Utah lawmakers want to say that's a damaging idea. It's hard to parse this, and it's because we're having a hard time getting to the bottom of what critical race theory is. And unfortunately, we're also out of time, and so we have to leave it at that. But Bethany, is there any way you can sum this up quickly, or are we done with this?
No, I mean, I think that that this is only the beginning of this conversation, if I had to guess. The state school board is still looking into this, and I don't think that state lawmakers are done with the issue either.
All right. And just with that, we're very low on time, and so at this exact moment, I'm going to turn to our final segment of the show, because we're saving time for a segment with Eric Walden talking about the Utah Jazz and their playoffs run. And so with that, I'm going to ask both of you to sort of change hats altogether, and we will turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Robert Gerke, if you're ready, I will start with you. Have you got a pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't necessarily a news story, perhaps, but, you know, the governor said the other day that the drought situation in Utah is lingering, and it's going to probably get worse by, you know, as summer moves on. And he expects there to be restrictions put in place on water usage. And so it just sort of drives home the point, especially, you know, and also a heightened fire risk. So it just drives home the point that we need to be vigilant about our water usage and prepared for a long, hot, dry summer. And I'll also put in a plug, give to KCPW. It's pledge week, and it's important that we support the radio station.
Oh, thanks, Robert. Bethany Rogers, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
My pick is a story by Tony Simrad. It's a really interesting story. For so long, we've been hearing that Utah is in a housing crisis because of a shortage of affordable housing. But this story is about how one housing economist with the state actually says that housing stock really isn't the problem, but it's actually wages not keeping up with inflation and the cost of living.
Wow. Check that out at sltrip.com. I'm going to forego mine in the interest of time, and I will just say Robert Gerke and Bethany Rogers, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. We're going to take another quick break here on the show, and when we come back, we will turn to that segment featuring Utah Jazz beat writer Eric Walden. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and this show is a partnership between KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Well, the Utah Jazz are headed to the playoffs, and Jazz fever has taken hold. Yesterday, I sat down with the Tribune's Eric Walden, who covers the Utah Jazz for the newspaper. Take a listen to our conversation. Eric Walden, Jazz beat writer with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Roger.
So the Utah Jazz have had a remarkable season. And before we get to that season, I kind of want to zoom out a little bit and talk about just how this team compares to previous teams. And I'm going to ask a kind of loaded question, which is, how good is the current Jazz team compared to the team that landed the Jazz in the NBA Finals in 1997 and 98, Eric? Can you compare the two teams? Should you compare the two teams?
It's natural to some degree to compare the teams, you know, just given that those are the only two teams in franchise history who've made it as far as the NBA Finals. And this is a team that became first in franchise history to finish all alone in first place atop the NBA standings. One of those teams, I think the 98 team, finished tied with the Bulls for best record in the league. This team was all alone by itself atop the standings. So, you know, the comparison is natural. As for the style of play, you know, this year's team is completely different. You know, they take more three-pointers in the first quarter of a game than Jerry Sloan allowed over the course of two or three games, it feels like. But it's an incredibly talented team. The comparison is there in as far as they're viable championship contenders. So from that perspective, yeah, it's totally fair to compare.
This was kind of a weird season, though, a pandemic season. And there's also been that kind of interesting, I don't know how to put it, interpersonal stuff between players on the Utah Jazz. Supposedly the team's two biggest stars, Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, had a kind of falling out. This feels almost like gossip or something, but Eric, was that falling out real? Did they patch things up? Do we need to worry about that as the playoffs get started?
It was real. It became kind of, you know, this was all born out of the beginning of the pandemic, you know, when Rudy Gobert became the first player in the NBA and in North American professional sports to test positive for COVID-19. And then that quickly led to the NBA shutting down, which led to, you know, dominoes falling of other leagues shutting down. Donovan Mitchell tested positive the very next day. And there was some fallout between them at the time. There was this report in, it's a sports subscription website called The Athletic. They got a source close to Rudy who reported that the relationship between those two was quote unquote unsalvageable because Donovan was so angry about Rudy's perceived lack of taking the virus seriously, taking the pandemic seriously. What I can tell you is that's long since been water under the bridge. They were angry with each other for a little bit over the situation. The gift they were afforded with the season coming, you know, being put on pause is they had plenty of time on their hands to kind of think over why they were angry and then ultimately get together and talk things through and resolve their issues. And what they ultimately decided is the Utah Jazz are better with both of us getting along and playing well together. And you saw both of them wind up signing long-term contract extensions with the Jazz, you know, months later. So that spoke to their ability to get along. And really, that's kind of been the catalyst for everything that's happened since.
And they have this mutual goal of you know, bringing home a title. We can talk about that. It's been an amazing season. The Jazz finished with, as you said, the best record in basketball. They are waiting to see who they're going to play in the first round of the playoffs because of the NBA's play-in tournament for the playoffs. And Eric, just before we move on, maybe you can describe or tell us where this play-in thing came from. What is this?
Yeah, this is a brand new thing. This is the first year that it's happening. You know, in years past, the Jazz, by virtue of having the best record, would have got the number one seed in the Western Conference and would have just automatically been matched up against the number eight seed in the Western Conference. This year, the NBA decided to do things a little bit differently. They created this play-in tournament. So basically, they're adding a few extra teams to the mix, giving kind of teams that would have finished in ninth and 10th place an additional chance to qualify for the playoffs. The hope from the league was that it would create fewer games where teams were just losing intentionally, right? Where they were just tanking in order to get better NBA draft position.
I was going to ask, what's the incentive for tanking? I mean, for like the naive listener out there, why would a team want to throw the game towards the end of the season?
Yeah, so at once the season is over, all these teams are involved in the NBA draft where they get to pick the best players out of college basketball. And, you know, there's a system in place that determines who gets, you know, the higher picks, who gets the lower picks. And generally it's weighted in such a way that teams who finish with worse records get higher picks, have a better chance at picking at the top. So, you know, in years past, we've seen teams that, like, once they realize, okay, we're probably not going to make the playoffs, it's never the players on the court responsible. It's kind of guys in upper management. They pass the word along to the coach, hey, maybe instead of playing these experienced veterans who are talented, you should start throwing some of these younger guys out there to get them quote unquote experience. And then as a result, the team gets worse and they lose more and they get a better pick who can potentially send the franchise onto newfound glory days. Yeah, basically there's more teams who got a chance to compete in the playoffs this year via this play-in tournament. And that's the reason why the Jazz still don't yet know who their playoff opponent is going to be. We started out with four teams in the Western Conference. We got a couple of results on Wednesday night that helped narrow the field. So now we know the Jazz will be playing either the Golden State Warriors or the Memphis Grizzlies, and that'll be decided on Friday evening,
which is tonight when listeners are tuning into this radio program for the first airing. So, I mean, there was a chance we were going to face the Lakers. That didn't happen. Now, as you said, Memphis or Golden State, is there, I guess you're a reporter, but you're also a fan, I'm sure. Is there a preference between those two teams in terms of who we would rather see? I mean, they're both obviously not the same ranking. That's not the right term, but they don't have the same
stature
as the Utah Jazz, but they both pose threats, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting. Someone asked me this earlier today, you know, like, who would you rather see? And, you know, I'm kind of two minds on this, you know, from a reporter standpoint, from a fan of basketball standpoint, I would rather see the Warriors because they have Steph Curry, who is quite simply one of the very best players in basketball, capable of changing results of games or very nearly changing results of games almost single-handedly sometimes. So I'd love to see that matchup. If you're a Utah Jazz fan, you would definitely rather see the Memphis Grizzlies because they're going to be a far easier matchup for the Jazz. They'll have to expend a lot less energy and effort in order to beat them.
I'm knocking on wood here, Eric, as you say that. Steph Curry with the Warriors, always a challenge. What about Klay Thompson? Is that guy, I mean, he's injured, isn't he?
He is injured, yeah. He suffered a torn ACL in the playoffs a year ago and has not yet made it back. There's been some discussion if the Warriors were to advance far enough that he could potentially, you know, make a comeback in the playoffs, but should the Jazz wind up playing the Warriors, he won't be a factor in that series.
Okay. Just because we don't have an unlimited clock, I'm wondering if you can talk about, in a broad sense, the keys to the Utah Jazz bringing a championship home for the first time in franchise history, meaning what is it going to take for that to happen this time around? Obviously winning, but, you know, what else?
So a few things. One will be the health of Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley. You know, at the end of the season, Donovan Mitchell missed the last 16 games of the regular season with a sprained ankle. Mike Conley had missed 9 in a row with hamstring tightness before he came back and played the final two. Keeping those two guys healthy is issue number one. You know, if they're less than 100%, if they're playing at half speed, everything immediately goes downhill.
And Eric, just on that point, we're speaking on Thursday. You went to the Jazz media availability. Donovan had a full practice on Thursday, right?
Yeah, that was the big news of the day. We'd been us local media types who cover the Jazz have been kind of putting in requests to speak to Donovan with the team's PR staff, and have been told we'll make him available as soon as he goes through a full practice with the team. And that finally happened on Thursday morning. And so that's a great sign for the Jazz. It's a fantastic sign for fans. He went through the whole practice. He acknowledged being a little fatigued because it was his first time playing to that degree in, you know, 4 or 5 weeks. But he believes he's on track to play in game one on Sunday. And that'll be great news for the Jazz.
Okay. So I cut you off, though. You said keeping those guys healthy is one big key. You know, I guess we don't have to worry about the interpersonal stuff because you said that's been resolved. Anything else?
Yeah, beyond that, you know, playoff basketball tends to be a little bit different than regular season basketball. You tend to see referees, the term is swallow their whistles, which means they tend to let guys get away with more than they would in the regular season. So, you know, things will be a little more physical. There won't be quite as many fouls called, probably. The Jazz are known for being a little bit of a finesse team offensively. They rely on spacing and ball movement. And those two facets of their offensive attack figure to be impeded a little bit by opponents being allowed to be a little more physical. So we'll need to see how they adjust to teams being allowed to get away with a little bit more. But if their three-pointers are going down and they're, you know, stopping other teams from hitting three-pointers as they were number one in the league at doing this year, that's a great combination for this team.
And then finally, I know I hate to count chickens or whatever before they're hatched, but I'm wondering about the teams that you see being, I mean, any team obviously could knock us out, but I'm wondering, like, as we make our way through the playoffs, what are the teams that you think pose the biggest threat to the Utah Jazz?
Yeah, that's interesting. When we were speaking with Quinn Snyder, you know, he made it a point to mention that this year has been like so bizarre from the standpoint of, you know, teams being impacted by COVID, by there being a shorter, more compacted schedule, that he's of the opinion that, you know, the traditional seedings of the teams matter far less this year than what they normally do. You brought up the Lakers earlier, and they're the perfect embodiment of that. A team that had their two stars miss significant portions of the season, and to the point that they were in one of those play-in games, and they're now the 7 seed in the Western Conference. The defending champions of basketball are the 7 seed and are facing the number 2 seeded Phoenix Suns in the first round of the playoffs. The Suns, who had the second best record in the league during the regular season and might not be favored to win their first round series just because now the Lakers have their two stars back. So the Lakers are a threat with LeBron James and Anthony Davis healthy. The Clippers are a threat with Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Those are probably the Jazz's maybe two primary rivals in the Western Conference. And then should the Jazz be able to outlast them and make it to the NBA Finals for the third time in franchise history, I would expect you'd be seeing them go up against one of either the Brooklyn Nets, the Philadelphia 76ers, or Milwaukee Bucks.
All extremely good teams. And it's exciting to see. And Eric Walden, thank you for bringing us up to speed on it. Eric Walden is Jazz beat writer with the Salt Lake Tribune. And thanks for making time for this. Really appreciate it again.
My pleasure, Roger. Anytime.
That's it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Go Jazz.